Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Today we're reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 52, Rukmini's Message to Krishna. We'll read text 36 to the end of the chapter, text 44. So we'll chant text 36. Evam samprishta samprashno. Brahmana parameshtina. Lila grihita dehina. Tasmai sarvam avarnayat. Evam samprishta samprashno. Brahmana parameshtina. Lila grihita dehina. Asmai sarvam avarnayat. Evam samprishta samprashno. Brahmana parameshtina. Lila grihita dehena. Tasmai sarvam avarnayat. Vaishnavis. Evam, thus, samprishta, asked, samprashna, questions, brahmana, the Brahman, parameshtina, by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, lila, as his pastimes, grihita, who assumes, dehena, his bodies, tasmai, to him, sarvam, everything, avarnayat, he related. Translation purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Thus questioned by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who incarnates to perform his pastimes, the Brahman told him everything, purport. The word grihita may be translated as grasp or caught, and thus exactly as in English may also mean to perceive or understand something. Therefore, Lord Krishna's transcendental body is perceived, understood, or in other words, grasped by the devotees when the Lord comes to exhibit his transcendental pastimes. These pastimes are not whimsical, but are part of the complex program structured and executed by the Lord himself for awakening the conditioned souls to their natural love and devotion for him and bringing them back to Godhead. There's a lot of verses, so I'll just read the translations. Sri Rukmini said in her letter, as read by the Brahmin, O beauty of the worlds, having heard of your qualities which enter the ears of those who hear and remove their bodily distress, and have also heard of your beauty which fulfills all the visual desires of those who see, I have fixed my shameless mind upon you, O Krishna. Purport, Rukmini was a king's daughter, courageous and bold, and furthermore, she would rather die than lose Krishna. Considering all of this, she wrote a frank, explicit letter begging Krishna to come and take her away. O Mukunda, you are equal only to yourself in lineage, character, beauty, knowledge, youthfulness, wealth, and influence. O lion among men, you delight the minds of all mankind. What aristocratic, sober-minded, and marriageable girl of a good family would not choose you as her husband when the proper time has come? Therefore, my dear Lord, I have chosen you as my husband, and I surrender myself to you. Please come swiftly, Almighty One, and make me your wife. My dear lotus-eyed Lord, let Shishupal never touch the hero's portion like a jackal stealing the property of a lion. If I have sufficiently worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead by pious works, sacrifice, charity, rituals and vows, and also by worshipping the demigods, Brahmins, and gurus, then may Gadagrija come and take my hand, and not Damagosha's son or anyone else. Report. The Acharya's comment as follows on this verse. Rukmini felt that no one could obtain Lord Krishna by the efforts of a single lifetime. Therefore, she earnestly pointed out the pious activities she'd performed in that life and previous lives, hoping to convince Krishna to come. O conquerable one, tomorrow when my marriage ceremony is about to begin, you should arrive unseen in Vidarbha and surround yourself with the leaders of your army. Then crush the forces of Chaija and Magadhendra and marry me in the Rakshasa style, winning me with your valor. Report. As Srila Prabhupada points out in Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Rukmini was born of a royal blood, certainly had a brilliant grasp of political affairs. She advised Sri Krishna to enter the city alone and unnoticed and then surround himself with his military commanders so he could do what was needed. Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti compares the coming fight to the Lord's churning of the ocean to extract the goddess Lakshmi. Gorgeous Rukmini, the goddess of fortune, would be gained in the coming turbulence. Since I will be staying within the inner chambers of the palace, you may wonder, how can I carry you away without killing some of your relatives? But I shall tell you a way. On the day before the marriage, there is a grand procession to honor the royal family's deity. In this process, the new bride goes outside the city to visit goddess Girija. Report. Clever Rukmini anticipated a possible objection on the part of Sri Krishna. He certainly would not object to subduing rascals like Shishupal and Jarasandha, but he might be reluctant to injure or kill Rukmini's relatives, some of whom might block his way to the palace's inner sanctum where the women were protected. The procession tour from the temple of Girija Durga would provide the perfect opportunity for Krishna to kidnap Rukmini without harming her relatives. O lotus-eyed one, great souls like Lord Shiva hanker to bathe in the dust of your lotus feet and thereby destroy their ignorance. If I cannot obtain your mercy, I shall simply give up my vital force, which will have become weak from the severe penances I will perform. Then after hundreds of lifetimes of endeavor, I may obtain your mercy. Before the divine Rukmini's extraordinary dedication to Sri Krishna is possible only on the spiritual platform, not in the fragile world of a mundane affection. And the last verse of the chapter, 44, the Brahmin said, "This is the confidential message I have brought with me, O Lord of the Yadus. Please consider what must be done in these circumstances and do it at once." Report. When the Brahmin arrived, he broke the seal of a confidential letter written in the privacy of Rukmini's quarters and meant only for Lord Krishna. By using the term Kruya Sandesha, the trustworthy Brahmin personally selected by Rukmini, here affirms that he had not violated the confidentiality of this message. Only Lord Krishna has heard it. Since the marriage of Rukmini was fast approaching, Sri Krishna would have to act immediately. The term Yadudeva indicates that Lord Krishna, as the lord of the powerful Yadu dynasty, should make his decision and then mobilize his followers if necessary. Thus ends the purport of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the 10th canto, 52nd chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Rukmini's Message to Lord Krishna. And next chapter, we will see what Krishna does. Somebody mentioned the other day this was somebody's one of their most favorite pastimes. It really is a remarkable pastime, a very, very wonderful on many levels, one we can really appreciate. Om Gyan Pramanisha, Gyananjana Slaka, Chakshu Nikamina, Tasma Shudra Namaha, Vanchakopati Vishcha, Vidisama Devacha, Patitano Pavani Vaishnava Namaha. I'm going to say a few things about this, and then I also want to talk a little bit about the recent GBC meetings in Tirupati and some of the things that occurred there. I realize I hadn't really spoken about that, and I don't know how much the devotees have heard about what we do. We do actually do some things in our GBC meetings, and I want to report a little bit of that to you. Going to the particular verses that we read, we have heard Rukmini's letter to Krishna. Very wonderful letter, very vivid letter, very amazing letter. And the two things stand out to me. First of all, that Rukmini displays the highest standard of pure devotional service. And secondly, she displays her Kshatriya nature. Okay. She mentions that she will accept no one as Krishna as her husband. Now, this is very remarkable because I mean, she's never met Krishna, even seen him. But she's heard about him, and she's worshipped him. And she's heard the glories of Krishna. She knows of his incredible beauty, his valor, his strength. And, of course, he is the eternal consort as the goddess of fortune. So she will accept no one as her husband. She's absolutely fixed on him, just as the gopis in Vrindavan are absolutely fixed on Krishna and can accept nobody else. And, in fact, she says she will give up her life if she cannot obtain Krishna. She says, if I somehow or another cannot get you, I will simply give up my life. And then, she says, I will perform penances for many lifetimes to obtain Krishna. She describes she for hundreds and millions of lives. She doesn't care how long it takes. She will do whatever she has to do to have Krishna as her husband. So this is obviously a very, very high level of devotion. And this is one of the hallmarks of pure devotional service, that one only accepts Krishna as one's Lord and nobody else. There's really no one else that can take the place of Krishna for the devotee. And a devotee devotes their entire life to him. It becomes really one's standard, one's purpose, one's goal in life is simply the lotus feet of the Lord. Of course, when they also worship other expansions or forms of the Lord, such as his consort Gaudarani or Rukmini herself, can be worshipped by the devotees, and of course, the guru, the spiritual master, who brings the message of Krishna. Rukmini also displays her Kshatriya nature here. I think this is very interesting. This is not a letter that probably one of the gopis in Vrindavan would have written. It's a little bit different mood, isn't it? First of all, of course, there are some similarities. They were willing to give up anything. They're willing to give up their families, give up their husband, you know, everything for Krishna. So there are some similarities there. But first of all, she says that this is a shameless appeal to Krishna. So she's very bold. I mean, she hasn't even met Krishna. And she's saying, I have chosen you as my husband. Now come and get me. You know, so she said, I'm just shamelessly, I really don't care, because all I want is Krishna, and I just, whatever I have to do for Krishna, I will do. Even if I act a little bit improperly or shamelessly and very, very boldly. So this is part of her Kshatriya nature. She also tells Krishna, when you come, you'll have to destroy all the opposing armies. She says, then crush the forces of the Chaija and Magendra. Magadendra, and marry me in the Rakshasa style, winning me with your valor. You know, and of course, this is very characteristic of Kshatriyas, and this Rakshasa wedding was one of, I think there were seven different kinds of marriages, or listed, eight, is it? Eight, okay, eight marriages, and one of them is the Rakshasa marriage, which means, it's only done by Kshatriyas like this, where you simply come in and grab the woman and fight off any competitors and take her away. Now, this works best, of course, if the woman wants you to grab her and take her away. I don't know what happens if she doesn't. But in this case, Rukmini obviously wanted Krishna to come and do this. And, of course, we'll see in the next chapter, that's exactly what he does. He snatches her away, fights off all the opposing armies, and picks up Rukmini to Dwarka, and they're very happy. Another thing she says, which is characteristic of this nature, she says, let Shishupal never touch the hero's portion like a jackal stealing the property of a lion. That's a nice expression. Shishupal is simply like a jackal. and Krishna is the lion. And it's like he's trying to somehow steal some remnant or something that's really owned by the lion, which is totally inappropriate, because Shishupala is actually unqualified and unworthy. It was interesting, wasn't it? Her father, what's this, her father's name? Darbha? What is it? Okay. He actually wanted her to marry Krishna. But her brother had made this arrangement. You know, he was understood Krishna and thought it'd be a good marriage for Rukmini. But Rukma, her brother, makes this arrangement with his buddy Shishupal. And, you know, for whatever, obviously this was for political alliances. You know, there's no thought to Rukmini's desire at this point, but it's for some political gain of, you know, the families coming together and Shishupal's armies and their armies. Rukma thought this might be a good idea to marry her off to Shishupal. And so that's what happened. He prevailed over his father's desire, and here we are, where she is just within days, a couple day or two of the marriage, and she's desperately asking Krishna, you know, please come and save me. Come and just take me away from Shishupal, which is exactly what he'll do. So while, and the other thing is, what's interesting, is she even plans a battle strategy, right? You know, and Prabhupada said, and I was reading Krishna book, he said that, you know, as the daughter of a Kshatriya, said she was very expert and aware of political strategy, you know. So even though she's a very fairly young girl, you know, this young, you know, and of course a very, very chaste and very beautiful young girl, very proper, but she has this nature. And so she plans a strategy of how you can come at this particular time when I'm going to be more by myself, you know, visiting the Durga goddess, you know, what you do for good fortune and marriage, you know, before the marriage. And she said, this would be a good time. Then you won't have to kill any of my family members. She didn't care if he killed Shishupal and his armies, but you may not want, she said, you may not want to kill my family members, so this would be a good time to do it. Anyway, I was really enjoying this as I was reading for some reason. I think Rukmini is a very wonderful, complex personality, and so of course very worshipful to us. Anyway, what's interesting, I thought, was this very, you know, which she shows later in the different, you know, relationships and rasas between Krishna and Rukmini, which are, you know, developed later in the Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, she has this obviously very shy, submissive, chaste nature. You know, she's a very, very wonderful example. You know, but at the same time, she also has this Kshatriya nature, which certainly came out during this pastime. And those two qualities are not incompatible. You know, we have many different qualities that we all bring into this world. And of course, it's interesting that, of course, you had in the Varnashram Dharma system, you had a certain, you know, place that everybody had. And, you know, there were prescriptions of the proper roles for men and for women. But there were also roles for Kshatriyas, and so those things also are there. And so there may be different conflicting roles that one has. And these all need to be balanced. And I thought this was kind of interesting because this really made me think that I should say something about our recent GBC meetings, because one of the features of our meetings, which is usually our midterm meeting, is not our main meeting, which is Mayapur in February, but this our meetings in October are around strategic planning. They're to be more proactive, more generating plans for the future like that. So I'm on the organizational development committee, and we had 4 days of meetings, and we have 5 days of strategic planning meeting, and really just one plenary session where we do our normal business. But this year was very different because we had this kind of issue that was a very large issue, and it was a very divisive issue about the role of female Diksha Gurus. And so we set aside 3 days out of that strategic planning time just for discussion on that topic. And so it was very thoughtful. It was very carefully done. There was much time given for exploration. Everyone was gave opportunities to talk, to share their ideas and their opinions. And we met in small groups and discussed different ideas, came back together, over 3 days. And I think that all the GBC members were very, very happy with the process, even whether they're for or they're against. People felt this was really a good process. It was very fair. It was a very good discussion. And Nitya Prabhu, who was our EC chair this year, did a really expert job, along with Brajabihari, really coordinating it, making sure everybody's feelings were there. Now, it was interesting because the last previous 2 years when I was on the EC chair and vice chair, it was very divisive. We'd end up with 13 to 13 votes and 14 to 15 and 16 to 15, and it was actually divided so down the middle of whether we should go ahead with Vaishnavis being able to become initiating gurus in our movement. But this year, after all this discussion, it was really a little different mood. And we came out with, towards the end, a very strong majority who say generally favored the idea of going forward with female Diksha Gurus or Vaishnavi Diksha Gurus. Now, of course, there were some concerns and caveats under what conditions this might be, and so that was also a large part that was discussed. I'm going to read the GBC statement in a minute on it that Nichima wrote. But what we were confronted with, and well, first of all, I think everybody knows my position. I haven't been secret about it. I've been very strong on this, and so I met, obviously I was for the idea of female Diksha Gurus. And we had to balance things like Srila Prabhupada's statements, our history in Vaishnavism, with other considerations that are also there. So we have statements like Srila Prabhupada said, I want all my spiritual sons and daughters to inherit this title of Bhaktivedanta, so the family transcendental diploma will continue through the generations. Those possessing the title Bhaktivedanta will be allowed to initiate disciples. This was, of course, very early. Maybe by 1975, all my disciples will be allowed to initiate, increase the number of generations. That is my program. That's what he wrote in 1969. But it wasn't that Prabhupada changed over time, and that was just meant for general encouragement. In 1973, in a Vyas Puja lecture, Prabhupada said, my dear sons and daughters, you have to become a spiritual master. You, all my disciples, everyone should become spiritual master. I hope that all of you, men, women, boys, and girls, become spiritual master. So that's fairly clear. He said, women in our movement can also preach very nicely. Actually, male and female bodies, these are just outward designations. Lord Chaitanya said that whether one is Brahman or whatever he may be, if he knows the science of Krishna, then he is accepted as guru. That's in a letter to Malati, December 25th, 1974. And then there's his discussion with Professor O'Connell. Professor O'Connell said, is it possible, Swamiji, for a woman to be guru in the line of Siddhic succession? Prabhupada said, yes. Janava Devi was Nityananda's wife. She became guru. The qualification of guru is that one must be fully cognizant of the science of Krishna. Then he or she can become guru. Ye Krishna Tattva Veta Se Guru Haya. In our material world, is there any prohibition that a woman cannot become professor? If she is qualified, she can become professor. So we have those statements, and then we have the fact that we look historically, have there ever been female Diksha Gurus? Has anyone in our disciplic line initiated? And we find that even within the Chaitanya era, we had Janava, obviously, who was Nityananda's wife, but also Hemalata, Gangamata, Garanga Priya, and Sita Takarani. They were all within Lord Chaitanya or the next generation, very exalted female Diksha Gurus. And there were also many others in the disciplic lines coming from Advaitacharya, etc. Now, of course, Advaita had six sons, three went bad, and three were good. So we're only talking about the good line. In the good line from Advaitacharya, directly, there's his son, one of his sons, that son had two sons and one daughter. And the woman, the daughter, is the one who is listed in that parampara as next in line. This is like a generation after Advaitacharya. So we have many examples of that. On the other hand, people were wrestling with the idea that Prabhupada said, not so many, in one quote, there are only a few, and that we have in our Varnashram system the idea of protection of women, that women should always be under protection, shouldn't be independent, this sort of thing. And of course, in the role of Diksha Guru would be fairly independent. Those were things that people were concerned about, and there were different considerations. My own feeling, and I don't really want to get in a debate about this or anything, because there's good arguments on both sides, but my own feeling is that you have the Varnashram Dharma considerations, and then you have Bhagavad Dharma. And Vaishnavas, I feel, follow Bhagavad Dharma, and Bhagavad Dharma trumps Varnashram Dharma every time. Srila Prabhupada said varnashram is external. He told Ramananda Roy to go on, go further, go deeper into, you know, what Vaishnavism is. And in his last few days of life, and I had this confirmed, I've said this before, by Bhakti Churuswami, I've asked him about this recently, he said to Bhakti Churuswami, he said, varnashram dharma is for the outsiders, he says, not for the devotees. So Prabhupada emphasized varnashram dharma because it is emphasized in our scriptures for the regulation of society. It's an orderly way that our society can be managed, that all classes of people, including those who are not Vaishnavs, you know, can be organized in such a way that everybody can progressively come to a higher standard of life and eventually become Krishna conscious. So that is the system that we use for organization of society. But the Vaishnava is above that. The Vaishnava is transcendental to any varna or ashram. And anyway, so many people feel this also applies to that we should not apply the bodily conception of life, you know, to what a Vaishnava can achieve. Anyway, that's my, you know, our feeling. And our final vote was about 3/4 of the GBC members agreed that we should go forward with implementing the idea of Vaishnavis taking the service of becoming initiating gurus. There was 3 against and like 6 abstained, something like that. But we want to do it very carefully. We don't want to create, you know, difficulties, and we don't want divisiveness in our movement. So we're going to continue discussing the considerations of how that might be implemented. Frankly, we may have to let India make its own decision whether in India whether they're going to accept this, and certain areas may choose to be exempt from this. And at this point, I think, you know, we have to kind of follow that. You know, but I think that the point is going to be established in next year in the Mayapur meetings. I don't know if any of you have seen this, the release by the GBC on this statement. I think the statement, it's a little bit long, but it kind of emphasizes, I think, the careful and planful nature of the discussions. In other words, this wasn't something where people were yelling at each other on different sides. It was really, really a thoughtful Vaishnav Sangha, I thought. You know, where we, even people who differed, we were really trying to get to the issues and get a better understanding, all of us, be a bit open. So, the Governing Body Commission of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness recently completed a special 3-day session during which the GBC body considered whether or not the worldwide Vaishnava community should endorse and implement the policy of having women serve as Diksha Gurus or initiating spiritual masters within this kind of society. The special session was held from October 16th through 18th and part of the GBC's annual midterm meeting. Some may be disappointed to learn that no final vote was taken, said Anutima Das, GBC chairman, but I think thoughtful ISKCON devotees will appreciate the GBC is taking a methodical, introspective, and prayerful approach to this issue and not ignoring any of the many viewpoints in its discussions. Preparation for the Vaishnava Diksha Guru discussion was exhaustive. The GBC Executive Committee engaged a team of researchers based in Chapati in Mumbai for over 2 months to catalog all the quotations on the topic from ISKCON's founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada, and other prominent acharyas or spiritual preceptors. In addition, they researched dozens of papers written by ISKCON members on the topic and cataloged these. And almost 1,000 pages of documents, Shastra quotes, and commentaries were organized and presented to the GBC in advance of the meeting, etc., etc. We wanted the members to be right in the right frame of mind for the meeting. Therefore, said Pragosh, vice chairman, therefore we started with quiet time for members to look over notes, reread articles. The executive committee of the GBC was not interested in facilitating a debate among people with fixed positions on the matter, said Seshadas, GBC second vice chairman. Our purpose and the purpose of the GBC was to have a respectful, deep discussion of the Vaishnava, the Diksha Gurus, and open our minds to try to understand what would best please Srila Prabhupada and Lord Krishna. Over the next 3 days, engaged in discussions, round-robin contributions, written responses, straw votes, etc. The three key questions arose during the first day of discussion. One, What social and cultural impact would a decision on the topic have on ISKCON? 2, under what circumstances might Vaishnavis become Diksha Gurus, especially in reference to Srila Prabhupada's statement that our lineage has women gurus, but not so many? 3, how does the relative role of Diksha and Shiksha Gurus impact, if at all, the question of women Diksha Gurus? Another critical question was sociological in scope. Vaishnav culture values the traditional family, including the important role women play as wives and mothers. Some members were concerned that if the GBC endorses VDG, that's Vaishnav Diksha Gurus, it will be misinterpreted as an endorsement of those Western values that contradict Vaishnav and Varnashram principles, including the sanctity of the home and child raising, said Anutama. That is not at all the message or the intention of the GBC. Discussion of the above issues took up on the second day. Third and final day was focused on assimilating points raised in small groups. This included what special circumstances, if any, are needed for the GBC to authorize women to initiate. Included were these questions. Should there be a minimum age requirement for female Diksha Gurus? Should there be restriction on the gender of disciples accepted? Should a potential guru have to demonstrate financial, ashram, and personal stability, which is also required in part by male gurus? Should there be a measurable requirement of Shastric proficiency? Should a history of at least 15 years of steady service to ISKCON be required? Now, of course, many of these could easily be applied to both, you know, men and women, so they really weren't that different. But there was some consideration as, in other words, should female Diksha Gurus, like, initiate brahmacharis? I mean, that's just one of those questions up there. Would it be better or more recommended to only initiate other women or grihastas, or, you know, not brahmacharis? Of course, some people say, well, you can't put any restrictions on the relationship between disciple and guru. It's a thing of the heart. But anyway, these are important considerations that have been talked about, and there may very well come out at least recommendations, if not restrictions, on some of these areas. One point stressed repeatedly was the need for cultural sensitivity. In particular, several members felt that if there were VDGs, there must be respect for cultural differences around the world. The final straw vote of the session showed that a significant majority of the body was generally in favor of having Vaishnavi Diksha Gurus in ISKCON if reasonable circumstances could be established, and a paper was written to explain the policy and ensure no traditional values or social sensitivities were ignored or demeaned in implementation. The EC was tasked to provide a paper clarifying the circumstances under which VDGs would be acceptable to the GBC body and the principal reasons for the policy, etc. And, of course, one thing that came out of it was we realized that having these more in-depth discussions and really taking time to study issues was very important. This is something we decided we're going to do, that every year we'll take 2 or 3 days to really discuss in depth some important, very, very important topic in our society. So we found that was very valuable instead of just, you know, a lot of crisis management and looking at 36 different resolutions, which no one really cares about, nobody follows, and, you know, that sort of thing. Excuse my cynicism. You know, I was a chair last year, and we had to wade through 36 resolutions, and about half of them I thought were a waste of time. But anyway, we really want to focus on right and under chair. He was Therese, our secretary, you know, and so he has to put them all together and deal with them, and, you know, so he knows. And anyway, I think we really want to try to focus more on important topics, you know, and really spend our time wisely like that. I think our time is, that clock is way off, and this one's only a little bit off. A couple other things I want to just mention real quickly in our strategic planning. By the way, we did meet at Tirupati, which is a wonderful temple. Of course, it's very well known of the Tirumala Temple on the hill of Venkateshwara Balaji, where 50,000 visitors come every day and 100,000 on the weekends. So we're somehow fortunate that we get these special VIP tours where we only have to wait about an hour to see the deity, which is really amazing. You know, most people wait like all day to get a second glimpse or something like that. But at the bottom of the hill is our ISKCON temple, the Radha Govinda, and it's very wonderful. And they have a wonderful guest house, and it's a nice place to stay. And they took care of us very nicely, and wonderful meeting accommodations and facilities. So in our strategic planning, I'm on the succession and leadership training committee. I've been on that for several years. And one thing that is very exciting for us is, we're planning this Leadership Academy. It's going to eventually be on this new property outside of Mumbai, but it'll take a year or two to build. We're going to get a very generous donation that Radhana Swami arranged to be able to build. There's going to be a temple and everything else there, but we're going to really build a full-on building and academy. In the meantime, we're going to hold the classes probably at the Eco Village there, also north of Mumbai. But we realized that one of our immediate necessities, we had to kind of shift gears. We wanted to start from the very bottom and work up with more training and more succession planning all the way through our organization. But we kind of have this crisis time right now with at the GBC and zonal secretary level, because there's so many top leaders who are going to be needed. Most of our GBC are getting close to retirement age. The next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a lot of turnover. And, we really need to get that next level up and ready. So we're going to focus first on what we call zonal supervisor level, people who can really manage zones. And some of them will be, obviously, will become GBC members. But we need people who can just manage the many, many zones that are going to be out there. As we grow, if we have 36 or 40 GBC members, they can't manage the whole world. We have hundreds, about 600 temples already like that. So we need another group of, they used to be called zonal secretaries or regional secretaries. We're going to call them zonal supervisors now. And, we already have 140 or something zones in the world already created or organized. So we need people at this level as well as GBC. So that's what we're focusing on. And we're developing it's going to start very soon. It'll start next March. The first coursework, the first 35 students, and I've been involved in the curriculum development and developing the course, and I'm particularly overseeing the online part of it since I do a lot of online teaching and have some experience in that. So anyway, that's kind of exciting, one thing that we were working on during that time. And many, many other things, of course, came out of it. Some of this is on Dundavats and if you get the Pam Ho forums and things like that, you can find out. There's more information on the things that are coming out of the strategic planning and our GBC meetings. Okay, all glories to Rukmini. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Maybe a minute or two if there's a question. A couple questions, maybe. Yes.
You said it would be a good idea to spend 3 days like that in the future on other topics.
Topics like, we have sort of this, we used to call it parallel lines of authority. I guess we call it just roles of authority. What is the relationship between our managerial line, the GBCs and temple presidents, and the initiating gurus? That's one I can think of. I can think of one of another one I had suggested was devotee care for leaders. we want to try to give devotee care to everyone, but we see our leaders or sannyasis sometimes falling down, sometimes they've expressed that they have no association, they have no one to talk to, they have no, so we need to create systems to strengthen that sangha. Trying to think what else people thought of, different issues. There's issues of one issue that people think are important is whether second generation devotees can initiate while their spiritual master is still present. Because some of the spiritual masters want their disciples to start initiating their senior disciples, but they're still living. Mm-hmm. Is that scripturally acceptable? And that's something that takes some discussion. I don't think it's a huge issue myself. I'm not real attached one way or the other. But many people think that's a real important, shastric issue that we'd have to decide. Things like that that just take a little more time, as opposed to just some of the more basic things. Other things that we worked on, talked about. We've developed a disciples course that we really encourage everybody to take who's contemplating initiation. It should be taken actually when it's a devotee right in the beginning. We're developing that, and should that be this? It's now, it's close to being mandatory. It probably will be soon. I think those are some of the things that, Oh, also, we're going to have another Sangha. We had the ILS last year. We had 1,000 leaders come to Mayapur, and we had programs with them. Next year, we're doing a program, another one for sannyasis and gurus who are not necessarily GBC members, because that's a really, really important level of our leaders that we need more connection with. Many of them operate very independently, often in a very wonderful way, and they do wonderful preaching, but we got to make sure everybody's connected. Know that we know what we're all doing and we kind of get on the same page as far as pushing our ISKCON movement forward. Well, thank you for all your help. I mean, it's really the devotees, the rank and file devotees of ISKCON that get things done, that do the work. And we have the greatest appreciation for all of you. Yes, Bill? One in the back and then Frank Govinda.
Term Diksha initiation.
Yeah.
So sometimes I hear that our first initiation is called Harinam initiation, mm-hmm. and second initiation is called Diksha versus Brahman initiation.
Okay.
So I just wonder if you could clarify.
Well, those terms are used a little bit interchangeably, particularly by us in ISKCON. By Diksha, we would mean first or second, either the Harinam initiation or the Brahman, the Gayatri, the Mantra initiation. We're really talking about both initiations. So in other words, if a female or Vaishnavi took up that role, they would do either first or second initiation. Yeah. Usually, they're not always the same guru that gives both initiations. Usually the first is, maybe 6 months to a year after the person's been steadily chanting, and then maybe another year or two. For some, sometimes it's 5 years with some of the initiating gurus. But, in a short time. Go ahead.
Want to be clear. So you're saying that Harinam is Diksha initiation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Being initiated into the Hare Krishna mantra is most important. Brahma initiation, Prabhupada said, is necessary for further purification, particularly for deity worship. First initiation or mantra, into the Harinam initiation would be sufficient to go back to Godhead. But Prabhupada said it's good for second initiation, it's a further purification. It's another step, it's another commitment, and it's necessary for our deity worship, for Brahman initiation.
As I hear, Prabhupada says this should be education-based, educating the members.
Yeah.
And I was listening in class yesterday, Prabhupada says in Allahabad, Kumbh Mela lecture, he says, so what's the difference with all these thousands of groups here versus us? They all have come for the same purpose, or we have come for what purpose? What is the difference? And then he break down, he says, the main difference is that they do not know what is the Jiva Tattva, Krishna Tattva, what is Bhakti Tattva, they do not know, but we do. We know the absolute truth as is. So then he says, our society should be education-based. This is our biggest difference between all these groups and us. So I was wondering, what is the GBC's emphasis on this, to educate every member of the world?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a word. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we talked a lot about how we want to make even Alachua, more of an educational center. And one thing, we've had this idea, of course, it's, there's sometimes only time between, concepts and reality, but there's also money sometimes between. But we've had this idea of this conference center for years, and if anyone has a few $100,000, we can make it a reality. But where people can, and the main idea of the conference is where people can come for education. And the idea of the eco farm that we're building is really for education, for people to come and understand Krishna consciousness lifestyle, become attracted, and then they can understand more and more about absolute truth, about Krishna Tattva. And so yes, that should be our purpose. And of course, we have now more and more, when new people come, we try to get them into Bhakta Vriksha groups and like that, so they can learn systematically. about Krishna consciousness, and we want devotees to do Bhakti Shastri and all of these programs where they can learn the scriptures in very careful ways. These things are very important. And going back to our topic at hand, Prabhupada said, what did he say? Ye Krishna Tattva Veta Se Guru Haya. But the qualification guru wants to be fully cognizant of the science of Krishna. So if one understands the science of Krishna, and obviously that's through education and through learning about our scriptures, then one becomes qualified. So, yes, important. That's the other thing that we were trying to do in these leadership and all this leadership training. And we actually always have two prongs to it, or two thrusts or two tracks on it. We have the managerial component. You know, you've got to, certain things you just have to learn if you're going to be a leader and manager. You know, you got to learn a little bit about finance. You got to learn a little bit about leadership qualities, communication, how to actually manage. But rather, we always have this other component, which is shastra and character, and getting deeper into how the spiritual character and qualification is primary. And if you don't have that, the rest doesn't matter. You know, it's like Prabhupada said, so many zeros without the one. So both have to be there. Spiritual education along with learning any other skills that are needed. Well, I think we're way over time. Okay, one more, then I'm ahead.
What's the qualification for being a guru now? Men or women?
It's kind of vague. You know, and I think it's been purposely a little bit vague because, well, I mean, do you mean from the Shastra point of view or like GBC law or ISKCON law?
I got a question that was sent in to me by a text message.
Okay, go ahead.
Just what the, we have men gurus now.
Yeah.
So what was their qualification?
Yeah.
That they're gurus.
Well, they must be studying Krishna consciousness, and they have to for so many years, and they have to obviously exhibit certain qualities. What for a person? Here's a system. If they want to know, a person is a 10-person committee. Like if somebody here wanted to be a spiritual master, they'd probably come to me, and then we form a 10-person committee of all the the leaders in the area, in the preaching area. And they have to kind of pass that the locals, because we wanted, the GBC really wanted to be local people who knew the person, you know, so they have to kind of, pass that through. Then it goes to the GBC, and if there's not three objections, then it goes through. There are three objections, then it goes to the GBC for discussion and vote. That's the mechanical process. It doesn't really explain what is the qualification of the guru necessarily, but that's the process, and hopefully everyone is looking. You know, is the person studying Krishna consciousness? Are they cognizant of the philosophy? Do they exhibit good character? Are they strong preachers? Are they capable of taking care of disciples? You know, I mean, there's some people who are good preachers, but might not have the propensity or the skill to really care for the disciples and to teach them and mentor them, which is absolutely essential. So all those things must be there. You know, Are we looking for Uttamadhikari pure devotees now? No. Any other questions on that?
On that same line, then, if it's seen that the guru who's already initiating doesn't have those qualities that you just mentioned, is there any kind of program to assist them?
Yeah, it's pretty well. Yeah, there needs to be. Yeah, we usually. That's something the executive committee. We had to take care of a couple situations like that. And the sannyas committee often is involved, and yeah, we've tried to work with people with problems. And you know, as Prabhupada said, you want to correct first before you throw them out or something. You know?
And just the last question: when you were reading those comments that Prabhupada had written about all of my disciples,
yeah.
I'd never really felt any pressure or any need, even though that was Prabhupada's statement. Is there any a thought to try to bring disciples up to that standard, to take on that responsibility? It seemed like the Prabhupada wanted, he said, all of his sons and daughters, but
yep.
I haven't really felt it so much, especially after 77, it seemed like it was...
an exclusive club?
It was for someone
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
You know, no one ever said, are you planning, or are you going to do this, even if
yeah.
you're Yeah. And I never felt that.
Well, it's we actually, you know, we passed one of those resolutions that nobody reads, you know, a few years ago, saying, you know, that basically, you know, the GBC said that we should actively encourage, you know, like senior Prabhupada disciples to take up this role. And, I mean, that's the official position is, yes, we want to encourage the senior disciples to take up this role. I think there's like 75 initiating gurus or 80 or something in a movement. And, you know, there's thousands and thousands of devotees, and there's thousands and thousands of potential devotees. I mean, you know, devotees are coming every day in every center, you know, all over. You know, we see them popping up and taking initiation. And it's interesting. We just saw... If anybody needs to leave, go ahead. It's 9 o'clock, but I mean, this is kind of an interesting discussion, so I'll stay a few minutes. Like Bhakti Marg Swami was here yesterday, and he initiated two devotees. Well, Bhakti Marg Swami is one who, you know, a good friend of mine, and he's always encouraging his God brothers and even God sisters, you know, to take up this role. He feels like, he says, why am I flying around the world initiating people? He said the local senior people should do that, who know the people and can take care of them, you know, and who can be there with them and guide them. So, you know, there are certain, I mean, some of our initiating gurus now are really encouraging other people and their God brothers and will be God sisters, you know, to do this. So, yeah, it's not happening as widely as it should, obviously. Yes.
And then there was one time I remember it said if someone wants to be initiated by someone who is an initiating spiritual master because they have faith in that person, then that person should be sent through the process. That was one of the criteria, that there's no sense doing it until there is someone who's interested.
Yeah, and that sometimes has happened. I mean, I've set up a couple committees like that because there were people wanted to take initiation from them, and the person said, okay, I'll do that if that's desired, and then they went through the process. That's usually a good way. It's not an absolute necessity, but I mean, if a person is actively preaching, I mean, sometimes a person, because they're not known as an initiating guru, then people don't think of them, but then it's kind of like if they are, you know, they feel, oh, there's a possibility. This, you know, I don't know. Kind of works both ways. Yeah. True Grumpy. Last question. I think we have to quit.
So, I think it's a very great decision that has been made, you know, considering our numbers in the world. We're just a minuscule in this world population, you know, but we're meant to dominate and to train the world. So,
yeah.
the more qualified persons we get to become gurus, that's definitely would be a great boost.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's definitely needed. I mean, and some parts of the world are growing amazingly fast. I mean, hundreds and thousands of devotees in different places of the world. Yeah. You know, like, you know, there's things like 3,000 devotees in the Ukraine, and some of these places like something or other Stan, you know, these little, you know, there's like 100 devotees, and there's several hundred initiated devotees in China, you know. And, yeah. Okay. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada.